Hello, and welcome to Motorpod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 594, and this is part two of a collection of interviews from the 26th International Ireland Classic held at the Phillip Island Circuit in Australia. Our roving reporter, Mr. Phil Hall, was kind enough to record some conversations with various participants over the course of the weekend. If you haven't caught it already, part one was released last week, and we featured Phil's interviews with Jason Pridmore, John Long, Jorge Guerrero, Josh Hayes, Mark Miller, and Michael Gilbert. That's available on our website. And as you may know, Jason Pridmore did suffer, unfortunately, nasty high side during the event, breaking his leg in the fall. For those wanting to know how Jason is doing after the crash, maybe take a minute to check out his Twitter feed. He's on Twitter at JP42. Happy to say that he looks like he's making strong recovery, strong progress, and we wish him the very best for a continued good recovery. This week, we have the remaining interviews for you. Coming up, you'll hear from Aaron Morris, who helped cement Team Australia's victory with wins in Race 1 and Race 2. Ben Neves, and I have to say, the start of this interview will probably pass into Motorpod legend. You'll hear why. It's quite comical. We have Dale Quarterly of Team USA, JJ Matter. We also have the AMA Superbike rider, Josh Hayes. And to round out, we have Michael Neves from MCN, who was at the event riding for Team New Zealand. Motorpod, I'd like to say a big, big thank you to Phil Hall for grabbing these interviews for our listeners. A thank you to all those people and participants who gave up some time to speak to Phil. We want to extend a very special thank you to Kelsey and everybody else from Phillip Island Operations for their help and support in making this possible. And especially a big debt of thanks also to our kind donors and patron supporters who make this type of content possible. Enjoy the interviews.
It's Sunday morning at Phillip Island. Weather is glorious, and we've just had race three of the international challenge for this meeting, the 26th Ireland Classic, and I'm talking to Aaron Morris, who finished third in the race, and you're probably really feeling like you should have won it, eh?
Yeah, oh look, you know, it's one of those things. It's a bit difficult in the sense that, yeah, we had bike problems, but you know, that's classic racing at the end of the day. It's we hit the front pretty early and we're looking pretty convincing, but you know, as we went on, as fourth gear started to disappear out the window, it was one of those things that basically went into survival mode, you know, and leading onto the straight last lap, you know, you're normally thinking you're going to be looking pretty good, but when she doesn't stay in fourth gear at all and you can't get anything, it's one of those things, you know, there's not much else I can do.
No, absolutely. I think you did sensationally given the limitation, because you went out on the track this morning knowing that fourth gear was suspect anyway, didn't you?
Well, it was actually third had a problem yesterday. We fixed third, and now today we had fourth. So it's one of those things. Like we didn't actually end up getting a new motor for this round, which we were meant to get. It didn't get finished in time. We had some problems with the crank, so that's the thing. We actually, a lot of the new revisions to help the gearbox out
aren't in that engine.
Yeah, they're not in place for this one. So it's one of those things, you know, for our first meeting out, we've done extremely well. But, you know, in hindsight, it's one of those things. It would have been really nice to have the gearbox good and ready to go.
Having said that, your scorecard for the three races reads win, win, third, and it's a long time. I've been coming here 8 years. It's a long time since anybody's done that, Team GB or anybody else.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I didn't come here expecting to go out and win the first two races, but that's what we managed to do. So, no, look, I'm pretty proud the team managed to get that all happening and get that together. So the fact that we're so close to getting three in a row, you know, it just shows you the boys have done a really good job putting the package together, you know. It's just little things let us down, but look, we'll see what we can do in the next race. Like, we've decided we don't have the parts to fix fourth gear, so we're actually going to gear it up, try to use first, second, third, and hopefully fourth hangs in there on the straight.
So what's going to be the strategy? Still go out and try and win, or nurse the bike for the sake of the points?
Well, I don't think it's going to make any difference nursing it to not, because I've actually got to stay on the throttle harder to keep it in gear. So yep. It's actually okay. Better a lot of the time to like drag the rear brake into the throttle and keep the gearbox loaded.
Stay on the gas.
Yeah, because it's actually a lot of the time when you button off the tiniest bit, when it goes to nothing. So, like, you know, it's one of those things, and turn 12 is actually one of the worst corners, because you have to accelerate into the corner, then shut it off, and then get back on it, and there's not a lot else you can do there. I actually tried to get fifth, but it jumped out before I even got fifth last lap. So it's one of those things, when you're cranked over, loaded up, and the whole chassis twisting up, they don't like getting the gears. And so, yes, it's one of those things.
So loading it and then unloading it is actually bad for it.
Yeah.
You're better to just stay on the gas and keep the gear in gear because it's loaded.
Yeah. If I can get it into fourth and drive it really hard, it will stay in fourth. But it has to be really cleanly into fourth, and then I really have to get full throttle really early. If I remotely wind it on, it doesn't work.
Right.
And the trouble is, you know, you can't just go zero to pin it every single time you get into fourth gear. It just doesn't work.
No, and it's not ideal to be booming into turn 12 at full throttle either.
Nah, that's exactly it. I think that'd be a crash waiting to happen. So, look, in a sense, look, there's a couple of times I could have definitely crashed in that race when it went to false neutral. So I'm pretty lucky in that sense. I had a couple of moments when it actually did go to nothing that I was relying on power. So, you know, even that in itself, and the rest of the boys managed to miss me, which is excellent. Because that's the thing, you know, when you have a problem like that, it's kind of a scary moment for me and everyone else. So,
because they don't know. You know, but they don't know. They're expecting you to do something and you don't do it.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Well, luckily enough, Steve and Steve already knew that I had a problem, and so did Sean. So they knew I previously had the problem, and they said they could obviously see I was starting to have some trouble with gears. So I'm guessing from there they probably actually started riding inside or outside of me just to be safe. Yeah, they wouldn't have been directly behind me, I'm guessing. Just so if I miss a gear, they could still make it around me. So,
well, they're not exactly novices, are they?
No, that's exactly.
They know how to do that sort of stuff.
That's exactly it. So in that sense, it's good to have a bit of experience behind you for sure. Like, it's simple things like that can cause big accidents.
Absolutely. Aaron, I know the Corrish boys pretty well. They live not far from me. I live in Wollongong. And Les is constantly on the phone to me, telling me all these secret things that I'm not allowed to tell anybody, which I think is extremely cool. But he's been telling me about this bike for months, months and months and months. And, you know, there's a saying that talk is cheap, and I wouldn't say that no disrespect intended to Les, but everything he told me has come true.
Yeah, well, that's a good thing, I suppose. Like, it's one of those things we knew we were gonna. Les always said, he said, I think we were in a good opportunity, but you know, Les was really coming here just hoping to beat the other Katana boys. I think it was much past that. He didn't know what was going to go on. So.
Well, because the general feeling around the paddock is that the days of the Suzuki are over. The general feeling is that you know, if you want to win now, you've got to have a Yamaha engine. And yet suddenly we find a resurgence of the Suzukis, and the Yamahas are nowhere.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. It's one of those things. It's the motors seem plenty strong enough. I'm not 100% sure why the boys haven't been liking the Katana engines. It's one of those things. I think it's probably more the chassis. Yeah.
The Katana engines, when you hog them right out, very, very hard to keep the oil inside. Very hard to keep the oil inside. The Yamaha engine is a bigger, physically bigger engine, and there's more space for you to bore it before you start getting close to the oil galleries.
Well, obviously at least the TBR boys have done a good enough job to keep the oil in it. So.
Indeed. Now, the Corrish boys, of course, this is a very emotional weekend for them, because it was, I don't know how many years ago, on Australia Day that their dad passed away. And Les said to me, he said, it's the anniversary of my dad's death on Australia Day. He said, if we could start race one on pole on the anniversary of my dad's death, he said, I'd be happy. He said, even if I didn't get anything else. And then, of course, you put it on pole on Friday, that punishingly hot day. And then you went out and run two races on the Saturday. And you know, those two guys are like the cat that's been at the cream. they're just over the moon. But yeah, of course, Ken Corrish was such an icon in Australian sport. Built the Corrish Vincent, the bike that Eric Debenham used to race. And you know, for old farts like me, you know, that is a really cool thing. And I was just so pleased to see. They say nice guys finish last. Well, they don't always. And I was really pleased to see that just happened just at the right time for them. And to be honest with you, and I'm not saying this just because we're on air, I think they picked the right rider as well. I really do. Because you don't have any presuppositions about this stuff. You come in here without a lot of background of what's happening here. So you didn't have to unlearn a lot of stuff to get on that bike and ride it hard.
Yeah, that's the thing. I hopped on the bike and just took it for what it was. Learn how to ride it and away we go. And as you said, like, it's definitely Les and Glenn yesterday were absolutely over the moon with the first two race wins. You know, like, he was definitely stoked. And you could tell there was a little bit of emotion there going on. He was just happy we did it and got the job done, you know. And it's one of those things, there's not much else we could have done. It was pretty much a perfect day yesterday. And we definitely... definitely couldn't have asked for any better.
And that race one, that's the first time you've done a race with a clutch start.
Yeah, that was my first clutch start, and that was why it was horrendous.
Reminding you about it because of that. I'm just saying it's remarkable that you came back and won, because you got really bogged down at the start, didn't you?
Yeah, I think ninth into turn one, which was wasn't ideal, but you know, that's what I get for not practicing starts. So I just took the fact that it'd probably be like a typical motorbike, and it was nothing like it. So that was sort of where I went wrong. But hey, it's one of those things. We've now stepped up to the plate. Like, that start was heaps better today.
Oh yeah,
I ran a bit wide in turn one, but you know, that was my own mistake. So I actually got off the line well. So at the end of the day, it's only going to get better for me, and we're only going to keep going forward.
So what is it like to ride compared to what you've been used to riding? What are the essential differences?
Well, the biggest thing is you're really a long way away from the handlebars. That's one of the biggest things, you know. Like, I've still rode a decent amount of classic stuff, so I've been getting more used to more flex and this and that, but this is the fastest classic bike I've rode in a straight line. And the old chassis tend to get a work up and they wind themselves up a fair bit. And yeah, it's one of those things, like a modern bike, you can sort of get it spinning and then you can shut it off and then get back on it and it's alright. These things, they tend to unsettle themselves a bit. You kind of want to, from when you start driving it hard, you really want to keep the power in, you want to progressively keep going faster. If you don't, the chassis can get all wound up and unhappy, and then they start wanting to wobble and do all funky stuff like this. So it's just different riding styles, but...
But you, the problem with the Katana, which is a problem that doesn't exist with even most of the other bikes in the paddock, is that you're not over the front wheel, are you?
No, we're not really over the front wheel barely at all, but, you know, it is what it is. It's actually, like, remarkably, the thing feels pretty good. Like, it actually feels pretty balanced. You don't feel like, as much as you're not over it, it doesn't feel that bad. I'd like to hang off a bit more. At times, it's definitely, I want to get a bit more weight forward, but, you know, it is what it is, and I'm not exactly the tallest person in the world, so...
And you haven't exactly got a lot of weight to put on the front wheel anyway.
Nah, I'm not that heavy, so it's one of those things. But, yeah, you do what you can and ride it the best you can and just make do with what you got.
Now, I've noticed over the weekend, you're very hands-on with the bike as well. A lot of riders just like to leave the bike to their engineer, the mechanics who built the thing, and just get on the bike and ride it. But you're really hands-on. You're involved with the bike as well as just riding it.
Yeah, well, that probably comes back to my background of being a motorcycle mechanic. So, you know, when you're a motorcycle mechanic and you get back to the team and you got to do stuff, I don't like sitting there and watching my whole team do it, you know, like, same thing, they're doing it for the fun of it. They're out here helping me as much as they can, so I'm going to get in there and help them as much as they can too to make their weekend better. So that's the thing, like, you're trying to do the best you can, so obviously you're going to get in and help.
Yeah, well, I noticed that you're down on the down on one knee adjusting the chain in there, and Les says to me, says he won't let me do it. He wants to do it himself.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I worked out where I like the chain, so I've worked out, because the trouble is our rear tyre is really close to our chain. It only runs about a mil off our chain, so
the old to fit in the fattest rim and the fattest tyre possible.
So I think the thing is too, having the young eyes is a little bit better for lining that just right. So
you're not saying Les and Glenn are old, are you?
No, what I'm trying to say is I'm still younger. They're fresher eyes and away we go.
I know exactly what you're saying. Well, look, mate, it's been a fairy tale weekend. It really has. And yeah, I want you to win race three, because I can't remember when someone won three races out of the four on the weekend. Certainly hasn't happened in my time. And I'd love you to do that. But, you know, at the same time, I don't want you to bin it trying to do that. I'd like to see you get as high up as you can and pick up that individual trophy for the outstanding performance of the weekend, and also help Australia win the international challenge. So I'm going to wish you all the best, but with a little bit of caution.
Thank you very much. Yeah, we do what we can and see how we go there. If it's feeling good, I'll push. If it's not, I'll just take the points.
Excellent. That's the way to go. Aaron Morris, two wins and a third in the three races. The International Challenge hasn't been done for a long, long time, and we've still got one race to go. So, Aaron, thank you for your time. Appreciate it. I'll let you get back to that chain.
Catch you,
mate. Thank you very much.
Okay.
It's great to welcome Michael Neves back to MotoPod. Ben, you're in a rather unusual position because you're an Englishman and you're racing for the New Zealand team.
That's my brother.
Pardon?
You got the wrong person.
I got the wrong person.
You want my brother.
This is what I said to you. So, Ben,
you can give me an interview if you want.
Oh, no, that's fine. Yeah. No, that's fine. Let's do it anyway.
Yeah, yes, do it.
So, Ben, what are you doing?
Right, okay. So, my brother, Michael, came here 4 years ago. With Colcox Motorsport.
Right, yes.
And did the P6 race.
That's right.
Then the following year, he did it again on the G6 O1100. And then the following year, he did it on a XR69. And then did a bit of GB timing as well. This year, he's on a XR69 TT Endurance bike from the UK, Team Classic Suzuki. And as the bike was spare the last couple of years, the GSX O1100, I've come over to race it. My racing at home is club level. I don't do a lot of it. But back in 2012-2013, I won the Junior Endurance 3-hour year championship. And then the next year I won the Senior. We ride for a guy called Keith Flint, who has got a pop band called The Prodigy. Pop rock.
Right.
He was the team owner.
Right.
And then in 2014, I stopped racing and started again last year, 2018. Had a break with a few housing commitments, things like that.
Oh, yeah, just boring stuff, yeah.
Yeah, boring stuff. But I came out here last January and jumped on the bike for the first time. Our first race in 5 years. Finished 7th, 6th and 5th, which was good. And Carl Cox Motorsport said, do you want to come back this year? So yesterday I qualified 7th. I've just been out now and got a good start, up into 4th. Got a slight problem with the bike, flicking a bit of oil on my visor.
Well, that's always a worry.
So I got pipped up going into Newquay Heights, and I just couldn't quite see, didn't have quite the confidence to hang on to the guy in front. I tried to hold my position and finish 5th. Did a good lap time. A few changes to the bike yesterday have paid off, and now the boys are in there checking out the oil leak.
And do they know the oil
cooler for some reason keeps on splitting?
Right.
You know, it's happened about 5 times in the last couple of meetings we've been here, and we can't work out why, whether it's the pipes, the unions, or the cooler itself. So we've just got another cooler going on, maybe taking a bit more care with the fittings. and fingers crossed be out this afternoon to try and fight for that fourth place.
Well, can I tell you something, Ben? And yeah. this is just something that I picked up here. 2 years ago, when Pat Mooney was out here with the American team, they were having oil cooler problems, and it was much hotter than what it is now.
Yeah.
And they decided to delete the oil cooler, and they ran without.
Yeah.
And they had no problems whatsoever. And it was hotter.
I said, can we run the engine without just plug the holes up?
Yes.
But it's an oil-cooled engine. It hasn't got fins on it.
That's the Suzuki with the oil.
It hasn't got water.
Right.
If it had water...
This is the very first GSX engine, isn't it?
It's an 88-ish, yes, something like that. Yes, it's 1100cc.
Yes. They're an oil-cooled engine. Okay, all right. Forget I said that. Yeah. That's,
I did ask that question, though. I said,
yes,
you did. Can we not delete it, but the engine needs
doesn't have sufficient cooling fins to take the heat away. Yeah, well, of course, oil, you get a few more spots of oil on your visor, that can destroy your confidence very quickly.
It did. On the second lap, I thought, shall I pull in? And I just, something said, just stay out. I stayed out. I'm glad I did. You know, didn't drop any oil, it was just a tiny splatter. But I'm glad I did stay out, and hopefully the next race we can get a better position.
Now, Ben, when you said before, you said that you raced endurance racing. What are you talking about when you're talking about endurance racing?
So, over in the UK, they do a championship where it's like a tag team on a transponder. So you do 3 hours. The championship I did was 3 hours, but now they're 3, 6 and 8. So you do your tank of fuel or your 30 minutes, come in, change the transponder to the second bike, and another rider goes out. So you do about 3 stints each over 3 hours. I did that in 2011 and 2012 on GSXR 1000.
Right.
Yeah, GSXR 1000.
So what's super stock sort of state of tune, or super bike state of tune, or
it was kind of super bike state of tune, minus the electronics. It had excellent suspension in it and a slightly tuned engine. Other than that, it was standard frame, standard swinging arm. Had some lightweight wheels, Brembo brakes. So yeah, slightly between stock and superbike.
On what tracks? Like tracks that we know, like Transhatch, Donington.
Donington Park, Cadwell Park, Pembrey in Wales.
Yes.
Anglesey in Wales. Alton Park. That's a nice circuit.
Yeah. That was where they used to hold the... No, that was Mallory Park, where they used to hold the race of the year, didn't they?
Yes, they still do that in Boxing Day, I think. I do that on Boxing Day.
Don't know.
There is a race they do on Boxing Day, but the race of the year might be the last race of their calendar.
Yes, because by then it's starting to get a bit cold.
Yeah.
Cold. And so you race endurance race. So on a they're traditionally fairly short tracks, the British sprint tracks, traditionally fairly short. So how many laps would you do
Brands
in 3 hours?
Brands Hatch.
Do you use the Grand Prix circuit or the Indy circuit?
So for 35 minutes, doing, say, 49 second laps, you know, you'd probably do 40 laps.
Wow!
In one stint.
Yeah.
So Snetterton is 3 miles long, so you'd probably do 15 to 18 in your stint. Yeah. But endurance race, I prefer endurance racing, because it doesn't matter who's in front of you or who's behind you.
You're racing the clock.
You're racing. The guy in front might not be the guy you're trying. You know, it's just a case of overtaking people and feeding through the pack.
Yes.
Which I like. And obviously the shorter pit time as possible, the quicker to get out of the pit lane as possible.
Yes.
The quicker to get in, it could save you a couple of seconds here and there.
And that's a couple of seconds, and you don't have to really work yourself hard on the track to gain back.
We once lost a race to second place by 3 seconds. The guy on the last lap, he overtook my teammate halfway round, just got him into a hairpin, then they followed each other to the end, and it was a couple of seconds over the line. That was how close he was. So we said, if our 6 times of coming in, 3 times of coming in was a little bit quicker, he could have made that time up. So endurance racing is
after 3 hours.
Tactical.
Well, yes.
Yeah.
It's tactical. Yes. Well, I love my endurance racing. I mean, when I first got involved in motorcycling back in the mid 1970s, I grew up on a diet of Gaudier and Jeannot and Jap Auto and Mead and Tompkinson and the Boldore and all those great European endurance races. That was what attracted me more so than Grand Prix racing. The tactics involved. And I loved endurance racing. And of course, then we had the Castrol 6-hour race here, which was a 6-hour production race with two riders and one bike. And that was on a 1.9-kilometre track,
which is quite small.
Yeah, it was one of our car racing drivers said it was a little bit like running a marathon around your clothesline.
Yeah.
But the endurance, that sort of endurance racing, I love that. And I really love the innovation. Like Gaudier and Jeannot, for example, and of course I'm talking before you were born, but Gaudier and Jeannot brought incredible innovation to endurance racing. They were the first ones to use the modular system where you took a whole piece, and if the bike crashed, you took that piece off and you put a whole piece on instead of having to replace a whole lot of little things.
Yeah.
They did it all in modules. And of course, again, you're talking about saving time. You know, the race is lost by 3 seconds, and they could rebuild a bike in ridiculously small amounts of time because they had this clever way of thinking about it.
So we had a race at Donington once where the rain was horrific, but we knew it was coming, rain was horrific.
Seriously?
And I still can't find a photograph for you. But yeah, the rain was horrific, and I went out first, and I must have been on my second lap, it started to spit, but the sky was black, really, really black. And the team said, right, just stay out for as long as you can on the slicks.
I was going to say, what sort of tyres were you on? Let me guess, you're on slicks.
And then come in for the wet change. But when we did the wet change, that guy then, I'd done my 30-minute stint in then 5 minutes, which you don't want to do. But everyone had to do it. So that was me on the Melbourne Loop.
No! Oh, that's not pretty. That's not pretty at all.
That's me on the Melbourne Loop. Yeah.
See, they're supposed to be the other way around. They're supposed to have the tyres on the bottom and the fairing on the top.
See the spark? It just started to spit, and the bike. So I pushed the bike from the Melbourne Loop all the way to the start line, and the guy couldn't then go until I gave him the transponder.
No, that's right.
So as I'm pushing it along, someone come running up to the fence, throw it to me. I threw it to him, I put it on the bike, he went and I pushed it back and they fixed it. With the weather, we came third. Unbelievable, we came third because of the rain and all the people crashing and all the tactics. So even if you do fall off sometimes, if you've got the right tactics, you can still do well. And the right team mechanics.
Well, of course, we've got a couple of very experienced endurance racers here. Steve Martin, of course. And Warwick Nowlan was a world endurance champion back in the day, and the Cutland boys have raced in world endurance racing. And so I talked to all those guys, and they say the level of innovation and sophistication in the endurance racing bikes in some cases is better, or maybe not better, but more innovative than what they're doing with the Grand Prix bikes.
Yeah, Grand Prix bikes, I suppose, they make them just to last that race, you know, as fast as you can in that race. Whereas endurance, it's a whole family, isn't it? So, yeah.
So, what's your plans for 2019? Have you been inveigled back into racing again?
I mean, after that race there, that was really exciting. So, I'm all look to do a few. My brother does a lot more championships, you know, a lot more different championships. I don't tend to do as much. This year, last year. I did Brands Hatch Grand Prix, Donington Park, Pembrey in Wales, which was wet for 3 days, and...
I was going to say, in Wales, it would be wet.
Snetterton, 200 layout. It's a 200 layout and a 300 layout. I did the 200. But Brands Grand Prix was my best, not best result, but my best, the most enjoyable this year. I had some instruction the week before from Terry Reimer,
best.
Terry Reimer was also a world endurance
champion.
And he gave me some good tips on Brands Hatch and good tips on riding, and which I've brought into practice here, you know. He said as soon as your bike is just coming up, get on that power and wait, get on it really early. He really taught me to push the tyre from quite a big lean angle.
Which is against
confidence.
Yeah, which is against the conventional wisdom that your brain is telling to you, don't do this
exactly
yet.
Exactly that.
My brain, but he's saying, do it now.
He's doing it now.
Yeah.
And my brain is like everyone's is working from you know, putting your power on there to putting it on more over there.
Yes, that's
right. Earlier you put it on, the more you got on the straight. So,
and of course, as a road rider like me, my rationale always is accelerate and brake when you're upright. Because that's what you do when you're riding
safe
on the road.
Yeah.
But it's a safe option, but it's not, you know, the safe option is not the fast option.
Yeah. So yeah, well, it's been nice speaking to you anyway.
Yeah, it's great. Look, and thank you for that, because I love my endurance racing, and I love hearing about, we have a similar thing that we do in our classic racing here, where we have a 3 hour and a 4 hour relay. They don't do the transponder. The rider goes out with a wristband, and then he has to get that wristband back to the next rider somehow before that next rider can go out.
Okay.
But they race on four different bikes, so they have a team of four, and each rider rides his own bike.
Yes, right, that's what we do, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But you know, the thing is, if you're stuck on the other side of the track and you've got the wristband,
you have to run back, or yeah, someone runs to you.
Yes,
you're allowed to do
or
that.
Someone throws it to you like you did. I like that.
Yeah.
That was very neat.
That was at the Melbourne Loop. As you come out of the Melbourne Loop, pushing it up the hill, and my friend's wife, bang, 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 passed it through the fence.
I love it.
And she put it back, so yeah, it was good.
Look, it's great to talk to you. And my apologies for mistaking you for Michael. And I probably should.
He's around somewhere.
I probably shouldn't have because, you know, I'm a twin myself. So, hey, what the heck? A good story is a good story. So thanks, Ben. And you have a great weekend.
And I'll see you a bit later.
And do you want to come back here next year?
I'd love to. Invited, yeah.
Yeah,
thank you.
Cheers, Ben. Appreciate it. All right. Well, we're back in the longevity. John Long's luxurious caravan, where we have a little bit of shelter from the sun and a little bit of comfort and some quiet to talk to MotoPod. And it's a real privilege to talk to one of the, well, he's not going to be happy for me to say this, but anyway, to talk to one of the legends of American motorcycle racing, Dale Quartley. Dale, your first visit here. Did I say that it was quieter in here?
I think you did, but I'm not sure that's true.
I'm not sure it's true. Dale, welcome. It's great to have you here. Is this the first time you've ridden Phillip Island?
Yes. Yeah, it's the first time. We've been kind of come over the last two or three years. As you know, vintage racing's kind of really taken off in the States. So we've been kind of come over the last couple of years, just so much going on with that Motor America side of the team that my vintage playing side takes second fiddle. About, it's probably 55th fiddle actually.
Yes, perfectly, yeah. Understandable. So Dale, tell me the Dale Quartley story. I live on the internet, on Facebook. I watch the photo sites about road racing from the 1980s, and of course you figure prominently in those, along with all those other names that I remember, you know, from when I started riding and the time that I've been racing. But racing at Loudon and Road America and all those tracks and so forth. 80s racing was really cool in America, wasn't it?
I was just talking to Steve Rapp about this too. One of the issues that people still don't understand, and it's hard to explain, but it basically goes this simple. RJ Reynolds' advertising budget was $2 billion, with a B, $2 billion, that all of motorsports worldwide was run from RJ Reynolds. So when we all had the Camel Challenge and the Camel this and Winston Cup Series, all that stuff was run by RJ Reynolds. So when we'd go to a race, you go to Mid-Ohio, let's say, there's 55,000 fans there. There's 150,000 fans at Daytona. But they're there because Andre Reynolds is advertising for months before. They got TV commercials. They got giveaways at the track. The pit passes are $8 because they're paying for half of it. That all of motorsports was run by RJ Reynolds. Well, it took a while when RJ Reynolds finally collapsed for everybody to absorb mentally what was going on, that all of a sudden the sponsors are having to absorb the TV costs. And the pit passes went from $6, $10, $12 to $28 overnight. And the average fan's like, I got tracks we go to in certain places. I mean, they're trying to get $45 out of you for a pit pass. I mean, you bring your wife and two kids in a weekend in a motel, and you're looking at $1,500, $1,800, so you just can't afford to do it anymore, right? So racing in my day was different for that reason. So if we want to talk about racing in my day without getting too carried away, racing in my day is 70, 80 bikes show up at Daytona, they qualify 65. We're sending guys home. The least number on the grids, 35 bikes, of which 20 of them are actually real super bikes. There's only a couple of fillers. Yeah, there's only a couple of fillers. But today there's two real super bikes, four support good guys like Yamalube, four support good guys that have a shot at winning, and then everybody else. So it's not the same conversation, right?
Yep, I understand.
If you want to talk about riders, that's a hard conversation too. Because in the day, there was 10 factory guys that all had a shot at winning. Then you had six privateers that had a shot at being in the top 10 every single week, maybe the top five.
Who were getting some sort of factory support as well, a little bit of money.
Yeah, getting
anyway.
Something.
That's right.
And because there were so many bikes on the grid, the talent pool, all of it, everybody was at 100%. Right? Nobody was out there cruising trying to make a buck. They're all trying to make sure they made a buck next week because there was too many people to take their job. Right? It was so, everything about it was different.
So Dale, what are your great memories of that time? I mean, they raced all sorts of things. Like they had one series just of people racing Honda VF 500s, a little
right.
500 bike, you know,
right.
And they had one whole series that was just dedicated just to that particular bike. And you got one of those bikes, and you went out there and you beat everybody stupid with it.
Well, it was back to the first piece, because basic racing was getting taken care of. The factories were dumping their money into supporting, like, the Suzuki Cup. Be a perfect example, right? You run a 600, you'd ride the Honda. Then 750 and 1100, you'd ride the Suzuki. So there was 10 guys traveling around the country, coast to coast, and most of them were dealing with each other's. And hey, you go to Texas and I'm going to Phoenix. Hey, you go to Indy and I'm going to go to Atlanta. Is they wouldn't show up at the same place, so they didn't race one another's, so they could all earn first place money across the country. But there was 10 of them doing it, and they all had 600s, and they were making $8,000 a weekend. But if they could win all three races, between that, the tire money, contingency money, chain money, helmet money, they were taking home $8,000 a weekend.
And the only time they actually met was at Daytona.
The only time they met, well, in that case, was at Atlanta, and they ran the WERA GNF. So there'd be 30 bikes on the grid with a shot of 20 of them winning the race. I mean, it was just sensational racing back in the day. But I'm going to keep on saying it. I know I'm getting sick of it. It's just different. Everything about it was different. It was just a different time and space. We'll never go back there. There's no way to recoup it, right? Now, today's racing is obviously way more exotic. You watch a World Superbike race, you watch a MotoGP race, and it's just phenomenal what those gentlemen can do with those motorcycles. But it's because the motorcycle's doing three quarters of it. There's a cool picture, you know, a perfect example is, there's a cool picture on Facebook that someone showed me yesterday that the photographer took, and I'm coming off of two, and I'm three quarters tucked in, side saddling the thing, and it's got a good little wheelie going. I got the front end cock because that was the only way to get the thing to not shake the nose coming off the turn. Well, you can't do that with a modern motorcycle. The computer won't let you. So it's either fix the chassis and fix the computer, or you can't ride it. In my case, it's like, well, I don't have time to fix the chassis. I only have 3 practices. I'm on my 3rd one. It's still not going right. I need to ride through it, which is just get the front wheel off the ground and it'll stop shaking, right? It's a different time and space.
So who are the great guys that you used to enjoy racing with?
I mean, Merkel was the man in the day. And then Schwantz came along. My buddy and I actually used to haul Kevin around because he didn't have any money. We'd haul him from race to race. And then he'd get on and he finally got the Suzuki ride. We still had to haul him for a little while because he had to pay off his debts first. So when he came up, he was super fast. Of course, when he came, Rainey came. Chandler was there. But when Schwantz and Rainey and... Spencer was just leaving, but he was still running a few events. When those guys came, I mean, it was just a different... 100% isn't a big enough word. I know there's no such thing as 105%.
Yes.
But basically, those guys were riding at 115%. I mean, they took the level of racing and upped it to the end. There was no half-coasting or half-saving a tire or... It's a 57-lap race. We get a cruise for a while, so we make sure we got tire left. I mean, those guys rode the thing to the cord.
Yeah. So did you race against Otis?
Otis Lance. I raced against Otis Lance in the day. Yeah, he was with...
Was he as crazy as everybody says he was?
It was hard to tell. You didn't dare to go pay attention to him because you get arrested.
Right.
Does that answer the question? I guess that answers the question.
Yeah. I think we'll leave it right there. Yeah. Well, I've been coming here to the Island Classic since, this is my 8th year. Otter came 7 years ago, and I don't know, it's just something clicked, you know. He and I just formed this friendship. He's just one of those guys. He's just a lovely guy. And I went and visited him his place in the States in 2015 after he'd had the big accident.
So yeah.
And I was sort of... try to encourage him and help him. I've had a big smash myself, so I have a little bit of an idea of what he's going through. But he is a real character. He's a funny guy. And when I was over there, I went to a race meeting at Crescent, and the word got around that Otto was at the track, and it was like bees to a honeypot. And all this good. And I thought to myself, yeah, what they say about him being a real legend in Texas is true. You know?
Yeah.
He really is.
But the cool thing about Otis is he, in the day, was mechanically as good as he was a rider. Mm-hmm. So he actually knew how to fix the problems,
yep.
Which meant every single race he went to, he was one of the guys to beat. He didn't have weak tracks because he knew how to fix it. He knew how to fix the motorcycle. Because of that, he knew how to adjust himself, right?
And he understood the dynamics of a bike and why a bike does what it does.
Right. Which is
rather than just getting on and twisting the throttle.
There's very few people that can do that, right? Yeah. Doug Pollen would be a good example. Doug Pollen, when we rode together for a little while, when I stopped in 96, I guess, we'd get off and we'd talk about stuff. And the mechanics would be looking at us like, what the hell are you guys talking about? And we're talking about all these little nuances that the motorcycle's doing that we kind of want to have fixed, but we weren't the primary riders. We were hired to fill in. But the riders have been riding the thing for a year. And the mechanics are looking at us like, what are you talking about? I say, it does this. No, it doesn't. I'm like, well, then you ride it. Yes, it does. And I look at Doug. I'm like, I'm saying it does blah, blah, blah in this section. He says, oh, 100%. He says, not only that. And then he'd add something to it. And the crew chief saying, well, why didn't we fix it? And we're like, I don't know.
Because
it's our second week here.
Because your riders didn't give you sufficiently accurate feedback.
Right. But Poland can hone you in on what it is, but he can't fix it. He couldn't go take the forks apart and revalve them and blah, blah, blah.
Whereas Mr. Lance over here could do
but
all
Mr.
that.
But Mr. Lance can do that, right? Oh. So that's Poland obviously made it farther. Sometimes you're better off playing to your strengths, right? I don't need to fix it. It's somebody else's job.
Yep, excellent.
Right.
Yep. So what have, Dale, what have you been doing over the time since you retired from racing full time? What sort of, how do you spend your day? What do you do?
Again, my ex-wife calls it self-unemployed, which means I choose not to work for on purpose. I've never had a job. I raced my entire life. Well, I worked for a dad at the used car lot when I was younger, which was 3 days a week because the rest of the time I was at the racetrack. But once I became a pro and I was making a living racing, I didn't go back to the used car lot. I worked all the way up until 9 years ago, I guess, racing full-time myself. I did the motorcycles, then ventured over into the cars. I was really successful in that. And then I got divorced. I had to stop everything for a little bit. And I took on some customer work. So at my shop, I work on race cars, mainly vintage race cars. And I've got a couple of high-end customers that pay me to really keep them going because I can keep them up front. And then on the side, I run a limited schedule myself in the cars, running the K&N E-Series. Again, I had to stop a couple years ago to my father. He got sick. I had to take care of him. And now that I got that taken care of, we started riding again, driving again. I've been doing some vintage motorcycles on the side. I've got a Motor America team. This year we have four riders, Bob Robbins and myself own the team, Quarterly On Track Development, it's called. We won the championship in 2017. Last year we were on par to have a shot at winning the championship, and the number one rider broke both wrists. And that set us back. We put the new guy on, we won first week out, and then he started having some problems, so we ended up, I think, 10th in points at the end. 2019, we should have a legitimate shot at the championship. It's looking good. We'll actually have four riders this year. So to answer your question, I will buy and sell anything. I bought and sold a crane the other day that I made huge money on. I've got motorhomes. I buy and sell campers, motorcycles, cars on the side. I got an eBay store that I make pretty good funds with. The customer cars and the race team I make decent money with. Between them all, I'm pretty busy. I'm having fun doing it. Every customer that I sell to comes back. It's because it's all first grade stuff. So I've got a good reputation. My vintage guys, I just had a new guy come in this past week, and I asked him, you know, why'd you come here? I haven't been to the car races in 8 months, I bet, because I've been too busy to go. He's like, oh, because when I walked around the pits and asked people that I'm really frustrated and I want this fixed, this thing fixed right the first time, who should I send it to? And every one of them said the same thing, send it to me. He says, but you're not going to like the fact that he's pretty expensive the first time you go there and it's a real culture shock. And the guy said, yeah, but if it's done,
why would I
who cares? And the other customers said, well, as long as you have that mentality, you'll be all set.
You'll be fine.
Because he's going to fix it, but he's going to charge you to do it because it's going to take him weeks to do it. He won't take it in 2 days, ship it again and say, you're good and pocket the $2,000. He's going to make sure you run up front.
Because a quality job is worth paying for.
I learned the lesson pretty quick when I took on customer work. That they come in, and the more money they have, the stupider they are. And they want to spend $2,000 to fix a $10,000 problem. You take that $2,000 and they're mad at you. And after I did it twice, I'm like, I'm never doing it again. That's not going to happen again. I call it A to Z now. Yep. When you bring the car into me, or your motorcycle into me, I go from A to Z. I start at the beginning, and I go through every step until I get to the end. So when it leaves my shop, I know exactly what it is, what parts in it, exactly what the numbers are. So if you happen to go to the racetrack and call me on the phone, I can answer the question. If you go to the racetrack and the car doesn't do what I said it did, bring it back to me and I fix it for free. You only pay me the first time, right?
Because whenever you're doing something like this, it is a grave mistake to undercharge for your skills.
Well, it took me millions of dollars to learn what I learned, and my girlfriend Brooke screaming at me when we first started dating about You're just not charging enough. You got to charge more. You're not making money. These guys are playing. They're spending money to play. Stop looking at it that you're saving them money. They're just going to go run another race. You got to charge them. And once I started charging them, more work came in. It was almost counterproductive to keep charging the guys more money because they couldn't handle all the work.
Yep, that's right. Exactly right. And I've had friends that have been in that same situation and they learned exactly the same thing.
Right.
You know, you do a cheap job, you'll get plenty of jobs, but you won't get customers coming back.
Right.
Just a quick one, Dale. You're involved in AMA now. Superbikes racing has gone through a really bad patch in the States over the last 10 years or so. Is it reviving?
I mean, we're going to go back to my first story. All the motorsports was run by RJ Reynolds.
Yes.
The sport's never going to recover. As much as I hate to make that sentence out loud, it's never going to recover. I personally think superbike racing should be changed into some version of super sport racing and call it superbike. And if you would accomplish that, there would be 30 gentlemen on the grid that can afford to go superbike racing. The way it is right this second, it changed for 2019, so let's start 2018. 2018, you had two options in electronics. You could leave it stock, or you could run this aftermarket kit. The aftermarket kit was $125,000. It showed up in a box. When you opened the box, there was some cool parts in there. When you went to download it to the computer said, "Oh, I see you bought a box. Good for you." That was it. You had to program the system. Well, I don't know about you, but I don't know how to program a 200 million bits of information system.
That sounds like a bit of a rip-off to me.
That's my point. But you can't, if somebody has it and they figure it out, you can't compete with them with a stock system. So you had to have it. So Broster's Chicken would be a good example. They basically put themselves out of business trying to deal with the electronics. Because without it, they can't ride it. They can't do those wide open 6-inch wheelies with the rear wheel spinning because traction control's doing it all. Yeah. You physically can't do it as a rider. So I'm saying if you want Superbike to come back, stop paying attention to what the rest of the world's doing. I get we're trying to send guys overseas, but you can't send guys overseas when there's nobody to send, right? I mean, it's just the way it is. There's nobody to send. Guys from overseas are coming to us.
Yep.
Because they can't get a ride over there, they come to us. We need it to go the other way.
Sure. Because, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think there's going to be another Rainey and another Schwantz and another Lawson. Much less another Spencer. Do you?
We had it. We built those guys because of American Flat Track. Those guys all started in the same spot.
They did.
But we also built those guys because every motorcycle brand was basically the same. You put a set of carburetors on it. You modified it to the nth. You went and ran it. And there was some suspension adjustment. And the rider did the rest. Because of their flat track background, the rider did the rest. Those guys elevated each other's week to week to week to week to week. And by the time they were done, their zero point was 150%. That's where those guys, their zero point was. And they went from there.
Yep.
Depending on one weekend they were at, one guy would get a fire under his ass because something that happened last weekend, Schwantz not beat me this weekend. By the time they were done, they were at 160, 170%. I mean, that's how we built world champions, was racing each other in the States.
Yes.
Which is back to my, if you want Superbike to take off, you need to go back to production bikes that you can only do a couple things to. And because of that, you'd have 20 guys on the grid that are competitive. Because you have 20 guys on the grid that are competitive, they'll elevate each other's every single practice,
yes.
Every single race,
exactly.
Every single main event.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
That's the only way to accomplish the goal.
Sure,
right?
Sure.
Otherwise, you'd be a fuel to take a Motor America Superbike, today's Motor America Superbike, and go ride it at 150%. Because you're going to crash. And you're going to be doing it for no reason at all. Because you're going to be out by yourself. Now you're going to be getting yelled at. So The Superbike guy
make
today.
Any money doing it either.
Well, the Superbike guy today, if they happen to hit it and they happen to have a killer combination like Yoshimaru had last year or 2 years ago, those guys put in 6 or 7 laps at 80% pace. And then they ramped it up to 90. Then they ramped it up to 100 for 5 laps. They got themselves a gap and they pulled themselves back to 80% and rode the rest of the day. But you can't do that in a World GP race.
Nope.
Right?
Nope.
But which means anybody in Moto America is not going to get there. And if they don't do that, they're going to get yelled at by their team because they threw the race away.
I understand what you're saying.
It's a vicious circle that they're stuck in. Right? It's nobody's fault. It's just...
That's just the way it
is. Just what happened.
Sure. Yeah. Dale, it's terrific to talk to you. Because I have enormous respect for what you did on the track in your racing days, even though I've lived here and never watched you race. But you know, your name is a name that is constantly mentioned in connection with the racing in that day. And when they said you were coming out here, I thought it would be really cool to talk to you, because everybody holds you in enormous respect, enormously high regard. For the racing in the day. You know, you were one of the main men in the day, and I thought, wow, that would be really great to get sit down and talk to you. You have exceeded my expectations in terms of the answers you've given to the questions, because you've opened up a whole new area that, because I've never been there,
right,
was completely closed off to me. It helps to explain a lot of why the things that are happening now are happening. But you've got the wonderful ability to be able to look at that to stand back from it and look at it and say, well, this is what's going on and this is why it's happening.
Right.
So right. That means a great deal. So I really appreciate your time. I know that the bike hasn't been super for you.
Actually, the bike is really fast and handles well. I mean, all that part's well. We just haven't, like I said, my Phillips Island first weekend. The race is sensational. The people have been sensational. Even rolling through track was a piece of cake. Everything about the weekend's been sensational, except we've had stupid little snafus. We had a $2 ignition switch break yesterday. We lost practice, then we go back out and we got a little brake problem, which was another $2 part. We got that fixed. We go out today. It breaks a brand new wiring harness. One of the wires, they didn't crimp it right. So now we're going through the whole system to make sure they're all crimped. But why would you check a brand new part, right?
That's right, exactly. But of course, that's the problem, because these bikes are not stock bikes. You can't go to the shop and buy a wiring harness.
Yeah, it's all one-off stuff.
It's all one-off stuff. You've got to make them.
Yeah.
And if you're 11,000 miles from home like you are, you can't just go down to your race shop and pick up another one.
Right.
If you haven't brought it with you, then you have to make do.
Right. Yeah, we just had to cut a $200 part apart to make do. This is going to cost us $200 when we get home. If we were home, we could have fixed it and bought this 50-cent tool and fixed it, but we're not home.
No,
right?
You're not.
We got to do what we got to do.
This is the peril of racing at a distance, isn't it?
No, yeah. It's good. It's been great.
Dale, thank you so much. And look, I hope your weekend looks up. And and even if it stays the way it is, it's been a great experience.
I hope you cool off in the next couple of days.
We'll cool off.
You better hope so.
But this
100 degrees it was yesterday, and it's still burning my shoulders.
Understand, yes. Yes, and this is summertime in Australia.
Yeah. So. I'm not coming then.
Dale, thank you so much for your time. I really
appreciate
it. Appreciate it. Thank you. Let's get started. Well, the afternoon. It must be getting close to the afternoon. Is moving on. Getting near the pointy end of the International Isla Classic here at Phillip Island. And JJ Matter, it's been a good weekend for the American team, but it hasn't been a good weekend for your bike and your rider, has it?
No, we've had issues every single session out, every single race. We've only had about 50 laps on the bike since we've got to it, so really, we're almost out here shaking it down, even though we should have been better prepared. It's my first time out here and my rider's first time out here, So as well as the bike getting it up to speed, we're also getting the rider up to speed. So for the results, you know, we did finish two of the races, and we got seventh in both of those. I think we could have easily moved into the top five had we not started out the weekend so rough. But since we only got two of the four session in on Thursday, that left us a little behind for the whole weekend to play catch up.
Now you had a jam throttle, which brought Steve down, and it's been, like you say, playing catch up since then.
Yeah, and in the first crash with that stuck throttle, it ended up damaging the throttle cables, and we thought we had it good enough that it would get us through. But unfortunately enough, it was just holding up a little bit, so our second crash was because the rear pushed the front. And so we just had a low tip over, so for the first or the next race, we set up with a new throttle housing and throttle cables that we borrowed from Kerry Andrews. And then one of the good mates from over here loaned us another windscreen, and we were up and running for the third race. That went well. Again, we finished seventh. Unfortunately, the rider noticed on his in lap that we had doused the entire bike with oil. We had pushed part of the valve cover gasket out, and it was just squirting oil like a pig. So we decided to call it quits. We don't want to take a chance on having that happen during the last race and taking other guys out. So we're just going to pack it up and try again next year.
Yes, they run on oil, don't they? And if the oil gets out, then yeah, there's a hell to pay, isn't there?
Yeah, there's a little man with a hammer that comes in and does damage.
That's right. Yeah, to say nothing of the other competitors who aren't happy if you're riding around with a mist of oil flying out the back of the bike.
Yeah, we were lucky enough. We did miss one gentleman, but he was able to get out of our way and, out of the way of the oil, and nobody went down in it, luckily. And we pulled immediately into the grass once the rider noticed that we did have oil coming out, and we rode around the grass to get back in. So we at least had the sense to do that.
So, JJ, what pays the bills at home?
Well, I work for Chuck Graves at Graves Motorsports. That's my daytime job. Then in the evenings and on the weekends, I do suspensionmatter.com, which is my suspension company. I do all suspension work, a variety of genres of racing, as well as I do rider coaching and chassis setup. So that keeps me busy with the hours I have free from Graves.
Based where?
Graves is based in Van Nuys, California. My shop is based in Monrovia, California.
Okay, so it never rains in Southern California?
No, we ride year-round.
Like here?
Yes, yes. I think we've had 6 days of rain so far.
Right, yeah. Now, JJ, I wanted to talk to you because we were just discussing off microphone, the issue with Steve's bike, and you started talking to me about AMA number one plates and stuff like that, and I thought, well, now, wait a minute, that's interesting. I'd like to find out a little bit more about that. So what's your history in the game? You know, what have you done?
Well, I started out in around 98, 99, and I was working at Jardine. Well, actually, let's see, that would have been, yeah, about then I started with Jardine. I started doing the exhaust program, and Jardine at the time was Factory Honda U.S. exhaust sponsor. So I got the luck of working with Nicky Hayden and Miguel Duhamel, and I ran the exhaust program for Factory Honda for those years, leading all the way up to Nicky's championship in 2002.
And so, was that exhausting?
Yeah. Yes, it was. It was very exhausting. A lot of exhausting. Once they seen what a good mechanic I was, not only with the exhaust, but as well as a chassis mechanic, I ended up being the fly-in guy for Honda. So I became a fly-in mechanic as well as the exhaust program guy. That went all the way through 2002. And 2003, I still helped out. 2004 or 5, I went over to Cowie, and I had the opportunity to work with Tommy Hayden and Roger Hayden, which if you look at the history, though, you'll see through 2005 through 2007, we got the number one plates with both those boys. I believe Roger got his first in 2007. So I covered all three of the Haydens with number one plates. That was nice.
Yeah.
And then had the opportunity to work with other riders, such as the Bostrom brothers. Ben was with Honda. Eric was with Attack Kawasaki and Attack Suzuki. We did a few rounds for Cycle World. So that was really pleasurable. And then moving forward, as I got out of the factory teams, I went to doing satellite teams, and I worked with Cameron Beauvais, got him his first three podiums, and now he's one of Yamaha's top factory riders. As well as my son, who grew up in the sport. He went pro at 16 in 2012, and we finished 4th, 7th, and 12th overall in those 3 years, and just couldn't quite get the help and support. But at that time, after 08, it was really a struggle to get sponsorships.
The sport runs on money.
Yes, yes, and TV coverage.
Both of which went very bad.
Yes.
When AMA handed over control to Daytona Motor Group.
Yeah, yeah, they promised us a lot and didn't deliver anything, you know, with DMG. We thought that might be the savior, but it just seemed to have gotten worse.
If anything, the sport went backwards, didn't
yes,
it?
Yes, yes, it did. You know, it's a shame, because I think there's a lot we could do to up that. You know, it's, you know, back when I was younger, the one thing that really thrilled me is we had a series called the Superbiker Series, where they took 2 to 3 rounds of flat track, 2 to 3 rounds of motocross, 2 to 3 rounds of road race. And it was a combination of all those races and points that chose the champion. And so it was neat to see the guys at stronger in different disciplines win certain events and the other guys finish in the middle. It was a really good mix of rider talent, and you really got to see who the overall best riders were. And I think something like that would bring back some of the spectators, bring some more money back into the sport. It would allow us to, you know, amortize sponsors over 3 different venues instead of trying to get a sponsor for just road racing or a sponsor just for motocross. You know, and the other thing I felt was detrimental was the fact that we have these spec rules. You know, back in 2002, you know, there was 4 or 5 fuel manufacturers, 4 or 5 tire manufacturers, and they'd each jump in and pay 2 or 3 riders each, you know, 30, 40, 50 grand to go out and run their product. And once it went spec rules, now you have to pay for everything, and there was no sponsorship with that stuff. I think that would be
because
another way.
Because they feel an obligation to.
Yes, yes. So I feel like that kind of hurt the sport and really kept us from being able to get more sponsors involved. So, you know, hopefully Moto America takes a look at this in the next couple of years and makes some serious changes to try to get our promotions back, because that's what it's going to take.
And this is all in the name of parity, which is designed specifically to keep the field close together so that it looks good on television and it's a good product for the sponsors to look at.
Right.
And it, what it does is it flattens out the field and doesn't allow the riders who are really brilliant to show what they really can do, because a half brilliant rider can do nearly as good. And so they say, well, you know, why would we spend the extra money?
Right, right, absolutely. Parity is key to good competition.
Yeah. And, you know, we don't want to have a rider winning by 9 seconds.
No,
you know, we'd
no.
We'd much rather have 5 bikes finishing within a half of a second of each other.
Yes, yes.
It doesn't matter that the whole thing is contrived.
Right.
But, you know, it looks good.
Yes, yes. I agree.
I'm sorry, I'm being very cynical, but, you know, that's... I'm with you. I just... The whole parity thing is just a complete nonsense.
Yeah.
So you're talking superbikers. Are you talking back, like... way back superbikers, like
85, 87?
Right, like...
Eddie Lawson era.
Steve Wise.
Yes, and Steve those, Wise, yes,
right,
absolutely.
Okay, those guys, yeah.
You know, I grew up just down the street from Eddie Lawson, and he kind of got me the bug in road racing, and I went out and rode at the club level for 4 or 5 years, and I was hooked after that, and I stayed in it building bikes and, you know, got my job at Jardine and showed my craft there. So it's just been, you know, a good ride for me and what I've got to witness. It's... You know, I wish it was as strong as it was back in the 80s, because, I mean, there was, you know, fun to be had and rides to be had.
And American riders who got to ride in Grand Prix and World Superbike.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. You know, we were really strong back then. You know, now it's hard to find an American that can keep up.
Well, and it's sad, because there must be those talented riders still. Talent doesn't stop just because... of something else, external circumstances.
Right.
There must be those extraordinarily talented riders still there, but they're just not getting the opportunity.
Absolutely, absolutely.
I mean, 85 was pre-internet, you know. My knowledge of what was happening was all through Cycle World and Cycle Guide magazine, which I used to assiduously buy here in Australia. I think Steve Wise was probably one of the most talented riders that America has ever produced.
Yes.
Amazingly versatile rider. He could do everything.
Yeah.
He could road race, he could motocross, he could flat track. He was brilliant. And, you know, it should have gone on, but it didn't.
Yeah. Yeah, well, maybe they'll take a look at it and we can get some of this back because, you know, and again, you know, with my son, when he started off racing, he wanted to do motocross. So we did motocross and then we graduated into flat track and from there into road racing. And, you know, it was neat to see the group of peoples in each of the discipline, and it'd be nice if we could get them all together, you know. So, you know, I'm hoping someone out there, you know, thinks about this and wants to put a series like that together because I have a feeling there would be a lot of turnout for it.
And it would be great television.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
It would be fantastic television. You know, it would be a terrific, in inverted commas, package, wouldn't it?
Yes, yes, absolutely. Commentators would have a blast with that.
Oh, yeah. Now, I wanted to ask you too, JJ, and it always seems to me that one of the major problems that American road racing has got is that Supercross is chewing up the majority of the sponsorship money.
Yeah,
is that correct?
That is true. The money is, there's still money in motocross in the U.S. But I got to tell you this, in probably the last 6 to 8 years, it's been diminishing as well. Not at the rate that road race did, but it's not as well off as it was 6 years ago. But it is definitely still strong.
Okay. So if you could get some of those top motocrossers to do some flat track and do some road racing, it'd just be a dream, wouldn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I'm pretty sure that there's a handful out there that do in the U.S. that do both motocross and flat track. Their weak point would be road racing, but it's funny because you get any of these guys that ride bikes and you get them on a track day and and they just fall in love with it. So, you know, I know there would be a lot of people that would show for it, you know, in the field of riders. So,
well, it was 1972, but when On Any Sunday came out, the whole premise of On Any Sunday was that it was a battle for the AMA number one plate, and you had to ride all those disciplines in order to win the AMA number one plate, correct?
Yep.
So Mert Lawwell had to ride road racing, even though he wasn't a road racer, you know?
Yep.
He had to do flat track, he had to do, short track and TT, which was sort of a modified form of motocross, wasn't it?
Yes.
And
yes,
you had to be competitive at all of those different disciplines in order to get the number one plate. You couldn't get the number one plate by just riding one
discipline,
of them.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was thrilling back in the day.
And what it did, and I'm not giving you a history lesson here because you know more about it than what I do, but what it did was it produced people like Kenny Robertson and Freddie Spencer and these guys whose strong flat track background made them great road racers in the days of the 500 two-strokes where you really needed to know where the front end was heading and what the back end was doing.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. You know, I like to call that era Men of Men because there was no electronics, there was no traction control. You know, their traction control was their wrist, you know, so...
The connection between there and there.
Yeah, yeah. These guys, just to watch them drifting both tires through corners at, like, Laguna Seca, was just so impressive, and it just, like, make your hair stand up on end. You know, those days are gone, unfortunately, but, man, those were impressive days to watch guys ride like that.
So with your involvement in the sport and your history in the sport, who's the rider that stands out for you as saying, this rider was the best rider that I had the opportunity to see and work with, you know?
For me, hands down, Nicky Hayden. Hands down. A kid could pull a white rabbit out at any given moment, no matter what the circumstances was, bike off a little bit, you know, weather conditions not right. I could always count on him with the last 5 minutes to shoot us straight to the top. It was just such a pleasure working with him and his family and his brothers. I mean, by far one of the best road racing families in the United States.
Now, you mentioned Miguel Duhamel, of course, because I started riding in 1974 and started following the sport. You know, my memory also stretches back to his father.
Yeah, Yvonne.
And Yvonne, he was the original crazy man, wasn't he?
Yes, it was so funny that you bring that up because I had the entertainment of watching Gary Nixon and Yvonne Duhamel go at it on vintage bikes at Daytona. Oh. And it's so hilarious because they were so competitive and beating up on each other.
Oh, yeah.
And I could only imagine what their whole road racing career was like, even though I was watching the end of it. And I want to say Yvonne ended up crashing out, and they had a big stream of his crash in photos, which was pretty amazing, and he got up and walked away from it. I forget how old he was, but he was very old at that point. And Miguel was like, yeah, Dad, and You know, Miguel, I like to call him the angry French Canadian, but he definitely had a lion's heart when it came to competition.
Yeah, well, I remember. Yeah, and Yvonne was the classic win it or bin it, wasn't he?
Yes, yes.
And yeah, and that was a great era. And those guys, you know, we look back on them now and we revere them, and as we should. I remember I've said in another interview with somebody else, you know, I always remember that Barry Sheen used to wear a Gary Nixon T-shirt.
Right.
And one of the reporters said to him once, "Why do you wear a Gary Nixon T-shirt?" And he says, "Because one day I hope I'm as tough as Gary Nixon."
That's awesome.
Yeah, and but you know, those guys were amazing. And Dick Mann, they were so tough.
Yeah.
But they had to be.
Yes, back then you had to be.
Because it was so agricultural and so dangerous. You know, they were ploughing a path that no one had ploughed yet.
Yes,
and they
absolutely
didn't know where it was going to take them. It was just amazing.
Talk about taking chances.
Yes, absolutely. Who's the guy who saws the cast off his foot and jams it into a boot and ties the boot on so he can go out and race.
Yeah, we you know, I can remember too, you know, back in the day it was a rough and tough. Remember a rider, I believe his last name ended with Russell, showing up at Daytona with a broken jaw from a bar fight the night before, putting a helmet on so he could go out and win Daytona, which was pretty impressive in itself.
And of course, if he had the helmet on, nobody could see, could they?
Right.
And the helmet probably held the jaw in place.
It was tough getting it off afterwards, though, let me tell you.
Do you feel that the sport generally now is a little bit too sanitized? A bit too clean and all neat and packaged? Where are those characters now?
Well, you know,
is there room in the sport for them?
You know, I think so. I think we still need to have the characters in the sport that make the show. You know, we still got to have a show for the spectators. So you want to have a couple bolsterous riders. You know, a little animosity, a little rivalry in the pits goes a long way on TV. You know, NASCAR, that's why it's so popular in the U.S. There's this rivalry, banging panels, you know, riders
jumping
yelling at each
out of
other.
The car.
Yeah, standing on the side, throwing their helmets at them as they come by, you know.
Well,
stuff.
I'm a mad Speedway man. I commentate at my local Speedway, so I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, yeah. You know, for me, you know, even though everyone says, oh, that's not, you know, that's bad sportsmanship, it makes for a good show.
It's a great show. But my point about that is the fact is, in making that show, do we lose the sport? Does the show become so important that we lose the sport part of it?
Well, I think there's a fine line. You could either get it too clean and sanitized and lose it, or it could be so rough and tumble nobody wants to be a part of it. So, you know, there's a fine line, but I think we need to figure out a good mixture of the two. You know, and for sure, you know, back in the day, riders didn't train. You know, they, you know, when you look nowadays, oh, a lot of the riders are fit. MotoGP guys, oh my God, are in such great shape.
Ridiculously fit.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, it's, I think all sports progress to that. But, you know, again, we still need to have some show. You know, so, I, you know, again, there's a balance there we need to find to bring the sport back to the U.S.
So, leading on from what you're saying in terms of moving away from that and moving to MotoGP, what do you think of MotoGP right now?
Man, it's amazing to see the technology and the development of all the machines. The money's out of control, especially with our economy, but that's the premier of the premier. So, you know, it's good to see it strong. I wish Dorna and FIM would try to help the U.S. a little bit more and make our show strong so we could be one of the three.
And us.
Yes, and the Australians series too as well. You know, there's a few good series out there. British and German series are good series too.
You're right.
You know, wish we could have, you know, I remember back in the day, Eric Bostrom and a few of the other U.S. guys traveling around to some of these events and doing them, and us being pretty competitive. You know, it'd be nice to get that back as well, you know. All the countries traveling within the countries, you know, for the national series. You know, but I think that's, we'll have to see what the economy does that, to allow that to come back.
Yeah. And of course, the major issue involved with all of that, of course, in the end, can be traced back to the loss of tobacco sponsorship.
Tobacco and alcohol. You know, unfortunately, those were the big money makers back in the mid-80s. So, you know, once we lost those, it was harder and harder and harder You know, and then, you know, it's weird in the whole aspect of sports because, you know, I try to get sponsorship.
Those two are contrary to anything about sport at all, aren't they?
Yeah, because, you know, I went to Motorola, which was a big company in the U.S., and to General Mills, who's a big multi-brand company, and asked them for, like, a couple hundred grand for a season, and they laughed at me, and they said, "You're not asking for enough." And I was like, "What do you mean?" And they go, "Well, we do World FIFA, the soccer. All our money's with those guys," and they told me the number, which was astronomical. And they go, "You're asking for pennies. We're not even interested." So then I go, "Okay, well, give me $1 million. I want to go do MotoGP." And they go, "Nope, our thing is in soccer." So, you know, there's other sports that are also sucking up the sponsorship money, you know, unfortunately. So, you know, I don't know what it would take to get some of that money back into road racing and the motorsport inside of the industries.
JJ, classic racing / vintage racing / historic racing, there's a world of difference between the way that you guys do it and the way that we do it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you found that out this weekend, haven't
you? Yes.
But would you like to see the same sort of thing that's happening here in the States?
You know what? I kind of felt like the crowd here is bigger, the grids are bigger. I think it's a more of affordable way to race. And I think it made for a good show, so I think it would pick up in the U.S. if we have it. You know, we have ARMA over there, and their events are pretty big. So, you know, hopefully this will grow, and it'll be another way for us to get the sport back.
Sure. JJ, thanks for taking the time to talk to MotoPod, talk to me. It is an interesting, I mean, I think always the sport is in a state of change. And I think, to a certain extent, the sport is always in crisis as well.
Yes.
And I guess it depends where it moves on from there, what's going to happen next. But we've certainly appreciated the way that you guys have stepped up to the plate, to use an American analogy, with the Island Classic. And the American team this year has just been fantastic. Really amazing. I mean, to have all those ex-AMA guys there is just really, really cool, and it's lifted the profile of the program, and you guys have really stepped in and filled up that gap that was left by Team GB not being here.
Yeah.
And we really appreciate that, because it would have been pretty flat, but as it is, you know, Larry and Steve and Michael and all those guys, they have really been stars. They really have.
Yeah, you know, and we also had Josh Hayes and Jason Pridmore out here, and they were going well too. You know, all these guys really enjoy coming over here. They love the track, they love the atmosphere, we love the people. The countryside is beautiful. I mean, this is my first time to Australia, and I can't wait to come back, bring my fiance with me. You know, this is just absolutely gorgeous out here. Reminds me a lot of our West Coast.
Yes, it does.
And, you know, and likewise, I hope to see some more Australians up in the U.S. racing. You know, it just, the sport and the camaraderie is just amazing.
Well,
really is.
Let me finish off by telling you a funny story, a historical story. In 1849, when they discovered gold in California, in the hills in California, a lot of people went from all over the world to look for gold. And one of the guys that went was a guy who went from Australia, whose name was Edward Hargraves. And he went over there to try and strike it rich. He didn't. He came back to Australia. But while he was over there, he was struck by how similar the hills around San Francisco and there were very, very similar to the sort of countryside that he knew in Australia, even down to the eucalypt trees. And he thought, you know what, if there's gold there in that sort of countryside, maybe there's gold here. So when he got back, he went out to a place called Bathurst, which is about 200 kilometres west of Sydney, started panning for gold in a creek there and found gold. And that's what started our gold rush, was because Hargraves looked at the countryside and the trees and the hills and the vegetation. He said, "That looks just like home." And it was.
That's amazing.
And the funny thing is, in 2015, I went over and visited my daughter and son-in-law in San Diego, and I went to San Francisco, and I went up in the hills of San Francisco and visited Ed. And he was right. It is. You drive through, aside from the fact that you're driving on the incorrect side of the road,
right?
You drive through the hills there. You could be driving in the Blue Mountains in New South Wales.
Yeah.
It's
that
similar.
Yeah.
It's
That's
quite
awesome.
Amazing. So, yeah. So you would be more than welcome back here. And
Why, thank you.
We've loved the contribution that you and the guys have made. And I hope you enjoy the rest of the time that you spend here.
Absolutely. And thank you for having me. Thank you for the interview. And I had a lot of fun. Thanks.
Well, that's JJ Matter. And it does matter. Thank you very much. Congratulations. First American to win a race at the International Challenge at Phillip Island. Just sensational way to finish off the weekend.
Well, I'm a bit lucky. I don't know that it would have been me.
Oh,
Jason,
not lucky at
Jason
all.
Was riding so good. If he were here, I think he would have possibly beat me to it. But, man, you know, Dave Krussel and the Mojo Yamaha guys, they did a good job. We had our issues in the second two races there, and we sorted it out for this last one. And I'm really happy to you know, American, that's good. Dave Krussel, all the time work, him and Larry Cook and the crew, Teague and Tony Romo and JJ and everybody's put into it. You know, all these guys have put so much time into it. I'm just glad to get a good result for those guys. They deserved it, and hopefully they can have a few beers and revel in this evening.
And your bike ended up being a bit of a bitzer because you borrowed some bits from other bikes to get yours to the grid.
Turns out it's been broken all along. I just didn't know it. So now it's actually working properly, and man, it was finally kind of on song there on the track, and hell, now I know what's some things I could do to go even faster. So,
do you want to race five?
Yeah, can we do a fifth one? That would help me in the points too, I think. So.
Congratulations, mate. It was a brilliant, brilliant day. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
You too. Bye-bye. It's 10 to 4 in the afternoon on Saturday afternoon. The weather's been mercifully good. It's been a pretty dramatic morning this morning with a huge crash involving Jason Pridmore and Bo Beaton. Both of those riders okay but hospitalised. But the International Challenge has lived up to its expectation. And right at the moment I'm talking to Michael Neves from Great Britain, riding for Team New Zealand this year, and of course also representing Motorcycle News newspaper in Great Britain. Michael, it's great to talk to you again, and what have you been doing since we talked last?
Well, it's really nice to be here. Thanks for great Aussie hospitality as always. And yeah, like you say, the weather's actually been quite nice today. Qualifying yesterday was really, really hot, wasn't it?
Sure was.
But then weirdly, I mean, you've been more used to this than me. It just changed 20 degrees cooler in the afternoon, wasn't it?
Yeah, 1 o'clock was like switching on a tap. Temperature dropped
exactly.
18 degrees.
Yeah, it was like riding in an oven for qualifying.
Oh, yes.
But yeah, this is my fifth year racing the Island Classic. I've been racing for Carl Cox Motorsport all that time. And it's been a real privilege to be with them for all these years. Such a great team. Carl's such a great guy.
He's so good for the sport.
And you know, him and all his Aussie friends. I've made loads of new friends over here, which is great. But this year is a little bit special because they've collaborated with Team Classic Suzuki from the UK, and they've brought over three bikes for us to ride. There's myself and BSB champ John Reynolds. We're on very similar XR69s, and they're both classic TT bikes. So one is an ex-Michael Dunlop bike, which is what I'm riding, and John Reynolds would be on a bike that I think Lee Johnston would have ridden. Then we've got Jay Lawrence, who's a real Kiwi, not a fake Kiwi like John and I, for the weekend. He's on the Team Classic Suzuki Katana, which John and I have actually raced in endurance racing last year at Donington and also at Aragon. So it's nice that everything's come together. My involvement with Team Classic Suzuki, my friendship with Carl Cox, and everything we do for MTN as well. So, you know, it's fantastic.
And of course, the bikes look glorious in those classic Suzuki blue and white, don't they? There's just something about that colour scheme, isn't there?
The colour scheme, but the bikes themselves are works of art. You know, Nathan Colombi builds the bikes back in the UK. The bikes actually belong to Steve Wheatman, the collector of a big Suzuki Grand Prix bike collector. And the frames developed by Nathan. You know, if you go up close to it, just the way the frame's manufactured and bronzed together is just beautiful. Lovely engines. They're a pleasure to ride. Yesterday, to be honest, we struggled a little bit getting them set up because they've only ever ridden on the roads before, where they need to be stable and they need quite tough suspension, and they're not really used to getting the high angles of lean that you get somewhere like here at Phillip Island. So we basically had to soften them right off to get some feel in them, and today they've been an absolute pleasure to ride. Really, really chuffed here.
Now, Michael, when you say on the roads, we need to clarify that from the point of view of many of our listeners who, of course, come from the United States, when we're talking about the roads, we're not talking about the streets. We're talking about true road racing circuits like Dunrod and the Northwest 200.
That's right.
And Cookstown and all of those.
Yeah, yeah. The real road circuits. Yeah, real road racing, as they would call it. Yeah, so yes. closed roads, but yeah, racing between hedges and lampposts and yes, all that kind of stuff.
Yes. Closer to the hedge.
Closer to the hedge, exactly right. And those guys have got balls of steel. I mean,
oh, yeah.
I probably wouldn't do it, but I'd like to. I would not brave enough.
Oh, I remember the late Dave Taylor, who I respected enormously, came out here and raced for Team GB a few times, and I interviewed him once about it, and he said everybody talks about how dangerous the Isle of Man is. He said the Isle of Man isn't really that dangerous. He said you set off two bikes at a time and you're racing against the clock. He said the true road races, in particularly in Northern Ireland, he said you got a field of 25 bikes,
yeah,
all starting off at the
Messed
same
up.
Time on roads, he said, where if you could take your hands off the handlebars and reach your hands out on both sides, you could
yeah.
touch the hedges on both sides.
Yeah, I've actually been to a couple of those. Walderston was the last one I went to, and it has to be seen to believe. It looks absolutely crazy.
Not even seeing it on television really conveys just
how
scary it is.
And the speeds they go, you know, massive, massive respect to them.
And little right-angle corners, you know, in the middle of a village or something. Other
yeah,
like
I know.
And they do this on wet roads as well.
Exactly. Yeah, they're crazy. I mean, that's half the reason our bikes are set up so stiff, really, because there's a lot of kind of dead-stop corners, aren't there, in road racing,
yeah.
where you just, you know, 180 mile an hour straight down to a 30 mile an hour corner. Yeah, exactly, or something like that. So yeah, but so Phillip Island's a really different proposition to that. But, you know, but other than that, this year, you know, my job at MCN as a road tester has been very busy. You know, we're travelling. This is a busy time of year for us. Between September and March, April is when all the new bikes are released by the manufacturers. So we're here, there, and everywhere. So
all the major shows.
Exactly. Well, it's all the launches. So last week we were in Mallorca riding the new Triumph Speed Twin. 2 weeks' time we're in Lanzarote riding a new Kawasaki Versys 1000. And then there's more or less a launch every week. I guess the ones I'm looking forward to is the new S1000RR launch, which is in Porto Mayo, or actually Estoril, at the beginning of March. Then there's a new Katana, which is in Japan, which I think is on April time. And yeah, it keeps us busy. We're always riding.
Estoril, that would be a real thrill.
Yeah, that's a fantastic track, actually. Yeah, yeah. And they don't race there anymore. They used to be Grand Prix, didn't they?
What a shame. Yes, yeah. That classic race between Rossi and Tony Elliott.
That's right.
And
well Elliott's, remembered. Yeah.
Pipped him right.
That's right.
On the post, you know, just backing the bike in sideways.
That's it.
Into the right hander at the end of the
straight. Yeah.
Rossi's trying to hang around the outside of him, and Elias made the bike about three bikes wide and left him
yep.
nowhere to go.
Yeah. Well, that was an important year, wasn't it? Because the Repsol Hondas took each other out.
Yes.
And Rossi could have capitalised on that, but Elias stopped him.
That's right.
And then Hayden, God bless him, ended up winning the championship, which I think was really nice. Yeah.
I have two major memories of Estoril. One of the is that, and the other one is the Formula One race. Would have been 97, I guess, or maybe 96, when everybody always said you can't overtake on the Parabolica, on the big long sweep just before the start of the main straight.
Yeah, yeah,
everybody said you couldn't overtake on there, and Jacques Villeneuve took Michael Schumacher around the outside of the Parabolica.
Yeah.
You're talking about balls of steel. Well, that was a balls of steel move too. And the commentators, they were just gobsmacked. They didn't know what to say.
Yeah, those were the days, weren't they?
They certainly
proper
were.
Racing. Yeah,
they
yeah.
certainly were. Yeah, I've always meant to ask you whenever I've spoken to you, because you're working for MCN, do you have friends and acquaintances who come up to you and ask you to tell them all the secrets that you find out about that no one else finds out about until later?
Yeah, they want to know. The biggest question I get, or the most frequently asked question, is what bike would I buy with my own money? You know, if
good question.
Yeah, or what's the best bike? But you know, the best bikes change all the time, because generally year on year they get better and better and better, and there's more and more choice nowadays.
And a best bike for one person is not the best.
Exactly,
bike for
yeah. But for myself, I like performance bikes, but I don't really like riding sports bikes on the road, because you can't do them justice and they don't give you any real thrill, because they belong on the track. But I like super naked bikes, so Tuonos, S1000Rs, Super Dukes, that kind of stuff. That's what floats my boat. Although the bike I actually own is a Yamaha T-Max. Big scooter.
Oh yes.
Yeah, I love it. I love it. Yeah, because I get to ride all nice bikes all the time. It's nice just to twist and go.
Yes, I understand that. The BMW
C650 Sport.
Yeah, the It's the 1000 SR, it's the SR1000 engine in a sort of an,
oh, like an adventure like frame. The SX.
The SX, that's right, yeah.
No, XR. Yes. S1000 XR.
XR, yes.
Is it? Yeah, it is.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it's too many letters, isn't it?
Yeah, oh, yeah. alphabet soup, isn't it?
That's right, yeah, yeah.
So that's a bike that appeals to
now,
me.
That is a fantastic bike. Yeah, yeah,
that's
those.
Appeal to my budget.
No, they're quite expensive, aren't they? But yeah, they will do everything, won't they? They'll tour, well, Australia, that's a big old place, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Michael, do you think that the days of the superbike are numbered in terms of road bikes?
No, because I think, well, in the UK at least, the track day scene is still very, very big, and the club racing scene. I know it's not the same in all countries, but you know, I think all the time there's strong superbike racing, you know, at world championship level and national level. The manufacturers are going to have to produce the bikes to let those guys race. I think in the future they'll become more and more of a niche bike, and already that's proved because they're very expensive now. You know, even a humble GSX R1000 is very expensive. So,
and sales of the big superbikes are declining.
Yep, they're going through the floor. And I think the most popular kind of bikes now are adventure bikes and retro bikes.
And the naked
Yeah,
bikes.
Because, you know, riders generally are getting older and they don't want to squash themselves up onto a sports bike. And it's a shame there's no new riders coming in. That's what really worries everybody. When we all drop off the end, then there's no one to replace us. Exactly, yeah.
That's right. Well, I'll tell you one thing I've noticed, and I actually remarked to a couple of other people about it today. I have seen more children in the pits here today than I've seen in all the time that I've been coming here.
Well, that's a good thing, isn't it? Yeah, that can only be good. And, you know, when you've got, you know, characters like Rossi and Marquez and people like that on TV to aspire to, you know, hopefully we'll get another generation into bikes. But, the, you know, it's different nowadays because when we were kids, a motorbike was your key to freedom. You know, you'd have to physically go and see your mates if you wanted to talk to them. But now with people online and, you know, Facebook and all the rest of it, kids don't need to actually move from their bedrooms to speak to their friends. So that kind of thing's gone out of it. Parents are more risk averse nowadays and the bikes are more expensive, the licenses are more difficult to understand.
The legislation is more draconian.
So there's lots of barriers in the way, but yeah, let's hope, you know, we all know how great motorbikes are and, you know, the sense of freedom you get and, you know, the thrill. It's almost like the world's best kept secret, isn't it? And it's lucky that we kind of know that secret. But let's hope there's more youngsters come into it.
And yeah, people say, why do you ride? But you can't really explain that, can you?
No. I mean, that's why I got a scooter. I use my scooter instead of my car. And I get puzzled why people would want to sit in a traffic jam on the way to work and, you know, want to go shopping if they just buy like a bag of groceries, why they'd want to take the car when a motorbike's so convenient. So, yeah.
I agree. And I always remember that on any Sunday, Bruce Brown's famous movie, you know, and he says, you know, why do they do this? But in the end he never actually answers that.
No,
because you can't.
No, exactly. Well, John Reynolds and I were just talking, we just finished a race, and that feeling you get, if you could bottle it 10-15 minutes after the race, you've had a good race, you've been safe, you've had a good time, there's no feeling in the world like it. You know, bikes just give you that feeling, which is, you know, it's like a drug, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, you would have had the opportunity, I guess, to rub shoulders with and to interview all the big names and so forth. What's some of the highlights for you?
I guess for me, you know, like all of us probably, I started off as a fan, and to get to speak to your heroes is quite intimidating. I was saying to John earlier, he said, oh, you know, who's the most difficult rider you've ever interviewed? And I said, well, none have been that difficult. It's just that...
Because they're not. Because,
no, because they're all decent people. Yeah.
When you actually sit down and talk to them, they're just people like you and me.
Exactly.
Who just have a passion for what they do.
Yeah.
If you can get over that...
Yep. Yeah, exactly.
Get past that aura.
Yeah.
They're wonderful people.
Exactly. I remember interviewing Mick Doohan. It was after he retired, and I was papping myself. I didn't really want to do it because I knew how little he thought of the press when he was racing, but he was the perfect gentleman, you know. If anyone was floundering, it was me, not him. You know, he just gave me all the really, really good interviews. So, yeah, I've never really met a bad racer there because... You know, with bikers, we've all got respect for each other because we all do something that's quite dangerous, and you know, there's that level of respect there.
And do you think that you, being a racer, can relate to them better in terms of, you know, what you write about them because you've actually done what they do?
Yep, in a way, but then equally, I think the more you know how to ride a bike, the more you realise how special top racers are.
They are very isolated, aren't they?
Yeah, just
they live in a different.
Yeah, exactly. They operate in a different world. Their skill level, their attitude, their work ethic. You know, yeah, the faster you get, the more you realise how special a Rossi or a Marquez is. It's just unbelievable. Yeah.
I always remember, some time ago, I remember one of the interviewers said to, to Mark Marquez, they said, are you the next Valentino Rossi? And he just smiled and he said, no, I'm the next Mark Marquez.
Exactly, yeah, that's great, isn't it? I mean, who would have thought Rossi could have been topped all those years and now Marquez makes everyone look ordinary?
But, you know, that is the inevitability of the sport, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah, there'd be someone who out Marquez's Marquez, wouldn't they, in a couple
that's
of years,
right.
Yeah.
So who are the names that you're looking at? What's the next generation that you sort of watch and you think to yourself, well, you know, that person's going to be...
Well, I think it's Rossi's VR46 stable, isn't it? He's kind of breeding a whole new era of riders. You know, it's going to be an Italian VR6 46 lockout, isn't it, MotoGP?
He's already got... people will be bitching about hearing the Italian national
exactly,
all
yeah.
the time, whereas now they're bitching about hearing the
Spanish
national.
And it used to be the Australian and the American, didn't it?
Yes, it did.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so it just goes in cycles, doesn't it?
It does.
Yeah. And we've got a fair few good Brits as well. I mean, they're mainly in World Superbike, but we've got Cal Crutchlow and we've got John McPhee in Moto3, so... Shame about World Superbike, actually. There's probably too many Brits. There needs to be more wild cards, isn't there? More variety in World Superbike. But, I mean, I'm more excited about British Superbike this year. You know, we've got Scott Redding coming back to BSB. You've got the new Ducati V4s. That's going to be spectacular. Almost don't want to race myself because I don't want to miss the action live on TV. But yeah, so that's fantastic.
Do you think World Superbikes have shot themselves in the foot by going to the pay-per-view situation rather than being able to watch it on free-to-air?
No.
I know it certainly put me off watching them because I haven't got the money to buy it.
But if it was good racing, you'd pay, wouldn't you?
Well,
probably.
Well, it is good racing, but I can't because I'm retired and I can't.
No, there is that. I mean, that doesn't help, does it? I think the big problem with World Superbike is the difference between the haves and the have-nots, and that's all down to the electronics they use. If you look at a Kawasaki and Ducati, they're a full factory team with an army of data technicians, and they're racing against people who might be a 4 or 5-man team who can't set their bikes up as well. So if they had BSB rules with no electronics, I think World Superbikes would be fantastic.
I absolutely agree.
Yeah.
And, you know, you can't say, you know, oh, it's boring because John Ray wins all the time. It's not his responsibility to go slower.
No, that's what Doohan said, didn't he? He said, what do you want me to slow down?
That's right, exactly. Yeah. And he's absolutely right. And the situation is exactly the same now.
Yeah.
I'm disappointed because I used to love World Superbikes, but it you lose, unless you're watching it all the time, you lose that connection.
That's right. And it's going to be it's going to be different this year again because they've got 3 races. So maybe if you miss one, you think, well, I can't be bothered to watch the other 2 now. You know, you need to be around all weekend to watch World Superbike now rather than just sitting on a Sunday and watch the 2 races. So be interested to see how it pans out.
So what's your travel plans? Whereabouts are you off to?
Well, next...
I guess you're off to Estoril?
Estoril, Lanzarote, mainly Spain, Portugal and Canary Islands, probably week on week, with a trip to Japan to ride the new Katana. And then in about April, May, it kind of dies down. And then I do a bit of racing myself, just a bit of club racing. I'm going to be racing the US 1000RR. I'll probably race the Team Classic Suzuki Katana in an endurance race, maybe at Misano, I think, this year. And I think we've got a modern endurance race on at Spa and Mugello this year. So, yeah, keeping busy, yeah.
So this is all taking place while it's freezing cold in Britain.
Exactly, yeah. This is a dream. It's 2 degrees and snowing in Britain at the moment. Yeah.
I remember one of the guys in Team GB. I said, "Why do you come out here?" He said, "There's 4 feet of snow in my front yard." What
exactly?
Do you
yeah, exactly. Yeah. No. So no. Today has been perfect conditions. It's what's it? Mid-20s. Nice breeze. Perfect. Track's nice and warm. You can use soft tyres. It's all good.
Media question for you, and you know, I don't intend to be offensive. I never ever try to be offensive,
no.
But there are occasionally people who say that motorcycle news makes up stories so they can fill the paper.
Yeah, no. It's the case with any big organisation. I suppose we call it Manchester United syndrome. When someone's big, it's easy to knock them, isn't it?
It is.
But the irony,
we call it the tall poppy syndrome.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
To lock down the tall poppies,
yeah,
and bring them back down to their level.
A lot of people say that to me with regard to bike reviews. They say, oh well, you're paid by the manufacturers to say nice things, but the reality is we're big and bad enough to be able to say bad things and not worry about the threat of somebody, Mr. Honda, saying we're going to take away our advertising. We'll say okay,
it used to happen, but it doesn't happen anymore.
So really, if anything, it's the smaller, like the bloggers or the smaller companies, that have to be a little bit more careful about what they say because they want a bit to be invited on the next launch. you know, but I've never met any fellow journalist who ever is swayed by a manufacturer or paid by a manufacturer. You know, I just think it's sometimes a little bit of sour grapes from people on the outside who see us having a great time.
And the fact of the matter is, Michael, that given the state of the industry, there are no bad bikes anyway.
No, exactly. The only time you get disappointed with bikes is when all the manufacturers know how to make a great bike, but somewhere between that design and it going into production, it's watered down because of costs, because of manpower or time or whatever, and it's not as good as it could have been. So you get disappointing bikes. But there's no bad bikes.
Or you get this wonderful design that comes out in theory, and you think, wouldn't it be great if they built it just like that?
Exactly,
but,
yeah.
But then they get cold feet and think, well, you know, if we build it like that, you know, it won't appeal to enough people, so it won't sell as much. And so they make it more
homogenized.
Homogenized.
Exactly. Exactly. Or they'll save $10 on suspension units, or you know, or something on the throttle, then it'll be snatchy and not a very nice ride. And you think, ah, damn, it could have been so much better.
Do you ever wonder? And I know that I do. Do you ever wonder? Sometimes it happens when a bike goes through design, R&D, you know, testing, and all the rest of that stuff, and it gets all the way to production and out onto the showroom floor, and there's something about it that somebody should have picked up along the way.
Yeah. You'd be surprised. You think, well, how did a test rider not notice that?
Yes.
You know, you can hardly get your feet on the foot pegs, or you know, the throttle is just like a jackhammer, or you know, all this stuff. But you know, I won't mention any names, but
No.
A couple of years ago we tested a bike, a superbike, which has basically got terrible brakes. Well, basically the latest generation of Japanese superbikes have got awful brakes because they've all got cornering ABS, and the ABS kicks in really early. They're all really conservative. So if you were to take one of these bikes on a track and trail brake into a corner, basically the brakes let off. So you know, you've got to say what you see when you're testing. And I remember one of the test riders saying, I don't know what you're talking about, the brakes are brilliant. And then later on, they rode one of these ABS bikes and said, oh, actually, it is bad. I've only ever ridden a bike with no ABS, which is fine. So, you know, little things like that, really.
Well, I had a mate of mine bought a 2009 or a 2010 Yamaha R1. I can say this because I'm not in the media. And he kept it for about 3 months and he sold it. He said the throttle was just so snatchy.
Terrible, yeah.
He said it wasn't that it was uncomfortable to ride. He said it just wasn't pleasant to ride.
Exactly. And Yamaha throttles have done that a lot recently. And I've actually, it was when the MT-09 came out. It had a terrible throttle just like that. And Yamaha said to me, oh, it's designed for people who, when they get on a throttle, they get on the throttle. You know, it's designed for hard riders. And I said, no rider wants that kind of throttle response when they're at full lean. They just want to pick up the throttle. No. And around town.
Racers do.
Well, even they don't. You want a soft throttle response, don't you?
Yeah.
A fast bike is an easy bike to ride, you know. We've been lucky enough to ride MotoGP bikes, and the thing that stands out is how easy they are to ride. I wouldn't know what it's like to ride at their level, obviously, but you could jump on and it'd be nicer than any equivalent road bike, because they work so well and they're set up by the best people in the world with the best components.
That's just amazing, because that's counterintuitive, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
The opposite of what you would expect.
Exactly. I suppose when you ride them at 100%, then they become evil, angry things.
Yes.
But yeah,
yes.
But generally they've got to be easy to ride, so the rider can concentrate on doing his thing.
Yeah. And what about electronics? You know, people say, oh, you know, hey, looks like Nino won that race. Oh, excellent. On the old Dick Mann replica Honda, that's a beautiful thing. What do you think about the people who say, oh, you know, the modern Grand Prix riders wouldn't be able to ride the old 500s?
I think that's wrong. You know, I think electronics are less of a help than people realise, you know, especially on road bikes. You very rarely bump into the electronics or use the electronics. And you know, I instruct at the Ron Haslam Race School in the UK at Donington on Fireblades.
One of our heroes.
Yes, fantastic guy. And those bikes have got electronics. And you ask the students if they can feel the traction control kicking in, and none of them can. No, nobody in their right mind really would ever just accelerate fully mid-corner. No. And if you did and it gripped, it would just send you wide anyway. So, you know, you still got to have riding skill. And I mean, look at the Marquez and Rossi. They practice on flat track bikes and they're sideways all the time. So these guys have got superhuman throttle control. And the electronics are there more really to conserve tyres and things like that, you know. And those bikes have got close to 300 horsepower, so they'd probably be unrideable without electronics, wouldn't they?
Oh, because Ron Haslam is one of my heroes.
Yeah.
I remember he came out here and raced in Swan Series back in 1980, I think, on that beautiful Honda Formula One bike, the cross the frame four cylinder one.
Yeah.
Absolutely beautiful thing. It was just so cool. And I used to love watching Ron ride, because he was a bit of a maverick, you know?
Alongside Burns.
Yeah.
I mean, Leon's like that now. Leon's a little fighter. He's a bulldog.
Yeah.
And he won the BSB Championship last year, and now he's off to World Superbike. So, and Ron's always by his side. You know, what better riding coach could you have as Ron Haslam, eh?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because I just wanted to even though this is interviewing you, I just wanted to tell you this story, because I know you know the guy. I interviewed Ron twice at two consecutive World Superbike events out here in Phillip Island when Leon was racing in World Superbikes last time. And I said to Ron, what about all this electronics and data logging and all the rest of that stuff? He said, oh yeah, he said, we still do all of that. I said, I noticed that you go out and you stand on their track out there. I said, and you watch Leon when he's practicing and when he's racing. I said, what do you do? He said, I just watch what he's doing. He comes in, and all the engineers swarm around him like bees around a honeypot. He said, and when they're finished, he comes over to me and he says, so Dad, what do you reckon? And he says, most of the time, he said, the input that I can give him is vastly more valuable than what he's been told by the electronics.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. I know Leon tells me that his dad will bollock him, even if he's won a race. He'll say, oh, you're doing that corner wrong,
Such a perfectionist.
Bit of tough love, eh?
Yes,
doesn't done him any harm, has it?
It hasn't done him any harm, no. That's right. Michael, it's so good to talk to you. I always enjoy to you, and I always enjoy getting a story from the inside. I talk to the riders, and the riders, by and large, like you say, they're terrific guys, but not all of them can actually express what they want to say because they're not used to that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I really enjoy talking to you because as a journalist, you...
I have to talk rubbish about bikes every day.
Exactly. Yeah. But the thing is, you know how to be able to say what you want to say, and it makes sense.
Well, thank you very much.
And,
very kind of you
really
to say.
I really appreciate that. And it's great to talk to you. We've been talking for 25 minutes.
Have we really? Wow, seems like five.
I know. Isn't it great? And that's the best way to do it because I don't like 5-minute sound bites.
No, that's great. No, it's a pleasure.
Michael, thank you again.
Thank you very much.
I hope you have a great time for the rest of this weekend. Look forward to catching up with your exploits during 2019.
Brilliant. Thank you very much.
That's Michael Neves from Motorcycle News and Carl Cox Motorsports for motopodcast.com. Thank you.